Hey, folks, thanks for tuning in to the CBSSports.com College Football Podcast. It is time for another edition of the Doddcast. So, as always, I'll welcome in the namesake, Dennis Dodd. Dennis is currently studying game film intently, aren't you not?
I am. I'm taking advantage of the newly added Pac-12 network to my cable tier here. It's pretty cool.
You know, the NFL now not only will let you have the condensed film, but for a $69 or $70 season pass, you can even get the all 22 coaches film cut-ups and get them right there on your computer and your iPad through an app called Game Rewind.
Well, that explains a lot then, because I guess Urban Meyer was giving it out for free. So why should he give Michigan State the entire game film? There's money to be made out there, right?
But doesn't that happen a little bit sometimes where a coaching staff will go through the game film and all of a sudden realize plays are missing and it can be, you know, I'm using air quotes here, accidentally dropped from the tape?
You know what? I will plead ignorance. You know, Jeremy Fowler, our colleague, had that blog yesterday, and he talked to a Florida staffer, a former Florida staffer under Urban, who said, you know, it had never happened there. And I will plead ignorance. I didn't know. You know, I don't know the intricacies of film exchange, and I hadn't heard of that happening. There's a website in the Big 12 that they all file to, Dragonfire, that's it. And it's created specifically for the coaches just to upload their game film. So there's no courier, you wouldn't do that these days anyway, but you can just go in there with the password and the coaches can get the game film. That's what I think Gary Patterson talked about that this week. So no, I don't pretend to know if that kind of gamesmanship goes on. So I wouldn't be surprised, but I don't know that for sure.
I like the idea. I mean, I think that we're moving as the college football fan and football fans in general are becoming more informed, and it seems like everyone's a little more interested in the X's and O's, which I'm excited about. But I could see all different kinds of game film being able to be available for fans, not just coaches, even at the college level.
Yeah. Oh, you're right. And I know you know this, Chip, that I think it's still out there. Playbooks were showing up on the internet. Kids would transfer and have them, or they would get out there somehow. Now, the difference is that, you know, at a place like Washington State, the playbook is on an iPad. Stanford has all the players carry iPads with them where coaches can update game film in real time. So if they're walking around campus at lunchtime, they can look at cutups. So I think you see less of that. But that was pretty controversial for a while when there was quite a few of them out there. Playbooks, you never knew how updated they were. But, you know, it was pretty fun to look at the size and scope and breadth of the stuff they ran.
And I wonder if, and this actually will transition us pretty nicely into one of the first things I want to talk about. I wonder if that is one of the reasons why the way that you seem to see the really successful offenses, a lot of it is, you know, the package plays. Like a quarterback goes to the line of scrimmage and he's got three different options. And so even if, you know, no matter what the personnel is, no one actually knows exactly what the play call is going to be except for the quarterback right before the ball snapped.
No, and the first time I guess I saw that, and now everybody kind of uses it, was Rich Rod at West Virginia, where every play was checked with me. You know, they would stop in the middle of the count or before the count and turn to the sidelines. They'd have the basic formation, but then the coaches could spy something, and then they would actually signal in the play from the sidelines. Then Oregon, I can't think, kind of refined that where, you know, the no-huddle offense, and Baylor obviously does that. And I think a lot of dare to say 90% of the schools at least have that in their package now, that package when they want to go fast.
Yeah.
So it's out there. And, Andrew Luck ran a pro style offense, and virtually every play would check with me. He had the ability, like, you know, we hear legendary stories about Peyton Manning, you know, just being the offensive coordinator. That's what Andrew Luck was at Stanford last year. He had full control to call what he wanted in the huddle, not in the huddle, but to change anything at the line, and had actually had a hand in the game plan. So that was him.
And so what you see a little bit of that. I know that Gino has the hand signals right with Dana. Like when he's going to the line of scrimmage, he looks up, Dana, you know, gives him the hand signals. And then his job in that offense is essentially to just look at the defense and then make a decision. It's that I think the thing that makes Geno Smith so good is that his read and react has just gotten better and better and better. And every single play on offense for West Virginia, there's one right answer and then maybe three wrong answers. But the one right answer should be unstoppable.
To me, it's the old Don Coryell passing tree, and he has given credit back in the 60s at, I think it was the 60s in San Diego State, for inventing this thing called the passing tree. That's why we have things called the seven route. He numbered all the routes. So instead of saying, go do a square, I'd just do a number one, two, or three. And in his system, inevitably, you know, it would outnumber the defense on some flank and there would someone be open. So in 2012, that's exactly what Geno Smith is doing. It just becomes a question of how savvy your quarterback is and how quickly he can check down. That's exactly what he's doing. And if you're playing Baylor, they're dropping eight and still letting receivers get behind them. So it's strange.
Well, and now Geno Smith will really be tested going up against Texas in Austin. And I was wondering, do you think there'll be almost like a Heisman hype hangover from his big performance a week ago?
Well, here's what's going to happen. Yeah, will it be tougher for him? Absolutely. West Virginia's playing its first road game of the season and first Big 12 road game in front of, you know, 105,000 fans at Texas. Texas has had a top 11 defense last year, even though they gave up a lot of points and yards. Last week against Oklahoma State, it's a quality defense. You're not going to see them have enough. You're going to see some three and outs or six and outs or something like that. I guarantee it against Texas. So the opportunities to score will be limited. I think one of the sidebars of this is how well the offense for Texas has performed, especially last week. And David Ash kind of came of age with that last minute drive that won the game. So I think it'll be another shootout. I think it'll be a shootout in the 30s instead of getting close to 70.
What's the what's your read on the game? Do you have a game pick yet?
I think Texas is going to win just because they haven't had time to plan. But that game Saturday had become so big and was so scrutinized by everyone. I talked to Manny Diaz, their coordinator, this week, and he seemed offended that, here they come, look out. His take was, we've got a pretty good defense too.
Yeah.
And during the bye week before Oklahoma State, they went and broke down everything. They looked at every one of their missed tackles. And these days, they're a lot with every team because nobody seems to know how to tackle. So he went and did that. And, they weren't great against Oklahoma State. You don't have to be great in the Big 12, and I still think this is a quality Texas defense. They've only got two seniors, but they're growing together. And I think there's a lot of pride involved here. They're going to look at that and say, "We're not going to be Baylor. We're going to change some things up. We're going to disguise some stuff, and we're going to blitz. We're going to take our chances." Baylor was in a submissive position all day, didn't really change out of it. That's what they chose to do, and ultimately it burned them, even though they scored 63 points.
Speaking of Manny Diaz, another young defensive coordinator that certainly a lot of people are talking about, particularly after last week, is Justin Wilcox, the Washington defensive coordinator. Washington breaks into the top 25 after knocking off Stanford and Seattle, but that time might be short-lived as they have to follow that up immediately by going to play under the lights in Outzen Stadium against the Oregon Ducks. Obviously, this week presents a challenge, but I was kind of down on Washington after watching the first three or four games of the season. Didn't really think they were going to be able to live up to the expectations of being that, third best team in the North, maybe. What's your read from this? Has your opinion of the team changed at all from that Stanford game, and how good can this Washington defense be?
Well, I was there Thursday, and I was down on Washington within the game. You know, they're down 13-3. You know, Stanford kind of got the tiebreaker there with that Trent Murphy pick six. And watching Washington play the game, there's no way they were going to come back. They didn't really attack. They attacked conservatively against Stanford, which has a really good defense. They threw a lot of hitch passes, tunnel screens, you know, just sideline stuff, sideline to sideline. Didn't really go downfield. Didn't really look like they wanted to or they were intimidated to. And the game changed on that 4th-and-1 where they went for it and stacked the line. And Bishop Sankey broke through and juked the safety, and that got them back into the game both statistically and emotionally. And they were able to drive down. I mean, Stanford didn't play a bad game. They had two busts on the 4th-down play and then on the 3rd-and-2 with 5:43 left when Cason Williams was able to take it 35 yards for a touchdown. I thought the bigger story out of that was not that Washington turned some sort of corner, but, boy, Josh Nunes, how bad he was.
He took a step back,
and you mentioned Justin Wilcox. That was very good. Justin Wilcox had a great scheme, which I'm surprised USC didn't try this against Stanford. They stacked the line with 8-9 players and dared him to beat him, and he couldn't.
Yeah,
they didn't have an offensive touchdown. So I think it'll be really tough at Oregon as it is for everyone. Washington doesn't have the firepower to keep up, and you know, the defense is probably underrated in Oregon. Not great, but underrated. And you'll probably see another bust-out game by DeAnthony Thomas and Kenyon Barner. So I don't think that will be very close.
DeAnthony Thomas, after that really hot start, has fizzled out a little bit. Chris Houston, our Heisman pundit, on we recorded a podcast yesterday. He called him the fancy hood ornament on top of the car because it's just shiny. And it almost seems as though Thomas and Kenyon Barner, you wonder if there's another level or another sort of wrinkle or fold in Oregon's offense that Chip Kelly's almost been waiting to break out through these first couple games, because they've really slowed their production. Barner broke out in this last game, but Thomas only has one touchdown, I think, in the last three games.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He had one Saturday night. He got 8 on the season, which still ties him for 3rd in the country in scoring.
That is true.
You know, still not bad, but you're right. It was, you know, he had 18 touches for 126, or 14 touches for 126 yards, and a rushing touchdown, which is kind of value added after they had won it. But you're right. Well, I'll tell you what, Washington State did a good job on him. They were the first team to kick off to him 3 times, held him under wraps, and didn't really let him bust out under the other 3 phases. So, he's going, you know, he's a guy that only needs to break free once in
right.
a game to break it open. I recall last year when in the USC Oregon game, I was at that one, and it was 38-14, and Lane Kiffin had kicked off to him all day. So he kicked off to him, and you know, 1 out of 3, a third time, he goes for the touchdown, which gets Oregon back in the game, the crowd back into it, and you know, USC ends up winning 38-35. But he was the spark that got him back. He is a great athlete. I mean, I was surprised how small he is when I saw him in person. He's 5'9". They list him at 5'9", 176. I don't think he's that much. But he's a great talent. I mean, who wouldn't kill for somebody like that?
Yeah. No, that's it. A touchdown waiting to happen is the value of that's incredible. All right, where are you going to be in Gainesville or Columbia this weekend?
So I'll be in Gainesville. I think that game is really a referendum on how good LSU is. I think the whole season has been kind of a malaise for them. They seem disinterested. They're not fired up. I expected the absolute opposite of a team that, you know, this is their revenge tour. They have a chip on their shoulder after the way they performed against Alabama and New Orleans. And they just don't seem like their heads are in it all the time. They've got a passing quarterback. They've been very conservative with him. Maybe they're going to break it out this week. I don't know. But if you're waiting till now, I don't know if LSU can turn on the switch. I mean, they really had one good game where you said, wow, that was impressive. And that's against Washington, where Washington contributed a lot to that. But letting Towson hang around, just kind of letting Idaho hang around, you know, was not impressive. I need to see more of LSU, and I think there's a good chance they go down this week.
And also the way that they, like you said, some of it was Washington, but when they were beating up on Washington, they did it in ways that, you know, made me sort of look down upon the Washington defense. And I just don't know, even with all those running backs, Florida's just a really bad matchup. Do you think that they've got talent on the outside? Mettenberger's supposed to be able to sling it around. Yeah. Do you think he's going to be able to do it on Florida?
Well, you know, I thought Odell Beckham would be a nice, you know, he'd fit in there nicely as the go-to guy, and that's partially been the case, but they just haven't run the ball with any conviction. They don't seem like they know what they want to do offensively. I mean, the default setting sometimes in the SEC, if you're not sure, is to just play conservative, pound the ball, wait for the fourth quarter, and let your defense either decide it or not. LSU's got weapons. You know, they shouldn't be screwing around to see if they can, you know, run the ball. We know they can run the ball against anybody, you know, at least four deep at tailback. They should have used these games more, I think, to develop the passing game, which is what they're going to have to do against Florida, because Jordan Jefferson isn't there to run the option. Now, the upside of that is that Zach Mettenberger is a better passer, but Florida's a better defense than anything they face this year on the road. So I think it's going to be really hard.
Yeah, I was about to say, the fact that Jordan Jefferson's not there, I think for a lot of Tigers fans, would be a positive heading into the Florida game.
Yeah, you would think so. But, you know, it kind of looks like, well, boy, maybe that option thing would look good this week. But, you know, they'll take what they have, and, you know, maybe they're just saving up everything. I don't know. If that's the strategy, it's a wrong one to wait till week six.
On the flip side of the ball, I think Will Muschamp, Brent Pease actually mentioned that, you know, they, one of the things they plan to do to give Driscoll a little more time is they're going to move the pocket and try and, you know, get him rolling out just a little bit. This is going to be a very, very tough challenge for the young Florida quarterback. But, you know, how do you see him being able to fare against LSU? It seems to me like he just needs to take care of the ball, because like we said, LSU has not shown the ability to get out and score a bunch. You don't expect that they'll score a ton on Florida's defense. It's like Driscoll really just needs to, you know, put the ball in the playmaker's hands and not turn it over.
Yeah, I really like him from the stuff that I've seen. I hate to bring this comparison, but he is more athletic than Tim Tebow. Now, he's not as big, but he runs, and he runs hard, and he runs with a purpose. He doesn't scramble. You know, he can lower his head and get extra yards, and he's pretty fast. And I love what they know what they want to do. I mean, you know, with Mike Gillisley, they have no problem with lining up in double tight ends and trying to smash mouth. You know, and that may be what they do against that good LSU defense, and then running some play action to keep them off balance. I mean, I think they have more of an identity on offense than LSU does right now. So I think they're fine there. It looks like a really low-scoring game, because I don't think LSU defense is going to let it get out of hand unless there's a lot of turnovers. But I give almost the advantage to Florida there, because at least they have an idea of what they want to do.
Right. Over in Columbia, Georgia and South Carolina, number 5 and 6 team in the nation. From the beginning of the season, they've each been sort of pegged as the SEC East front runners and teams that at least have the ability to knock off whoever wins in the West in the SEC championship game if they can get there. You know, obviously, Florida presents an entirely new threat to that SEC East race. Mm-hmm. And to me, it seems like this is almost an elimination in the gauntlet. You know, the loser here is going to find themselves in a tough position if they want to be able to climb up and get a spot in the Georgia Dome. From we've seen up and down performances from Georgia and South Carolina. The Gamecocks obviously woke up after getting hit in the mouth a little bit by Kentucky, maybe caught off guard by the backup quarterback. How are you seeing that game playing out, and where are you giving an edge?
Well, I think you're right. I think the first thing you mentioned, South Carolina has to win this game because of their schedule. It's tougher. They go Georgia, and then they go Florida. I think that's it. I think they go to Florida or LSU. I can't remember which. I had it written down here. But they play a tougher schedule overall. Georgia can afford, you know, the question is who can afford a loss more. and it's Georgia because of South Carolina's schedule. Whoever loses this game is really two games behind, because if they tie with one loss each, then the tiebreaker goes head-to-head to the winner. So you're really at a disadvantage. But because it's Carolina, you know, they still have to play at Kentucky. Well, I'm looking at Georgia's schedule. I had South Carolina's written down here. But they have, yeah, they still have to play Clemson. They have back-to-back trips to LSU and Florida. So it's incumbent upon them to win this game, just to keep the hope alive of winning the SEC. This doesn't clinch it by any means. They've got a tougher schedule.
What's the chances that Notre Dame, as high as they've been right now, gets shocked by a hot and lively Miami bunch that's coming into Chicago on Saturday night?
Oh, I think very good, just because of what you said. I think Miami's hot. Stephen Morris had the 550-yard or 60-yard game against NC State, and looked like he'd broken out a little bit. They needed every one of those yards to win. You know, when this season started, I looked at that game and, well, it's nice for historical perspective. Now I'm hoping there's got to be a tunnel somewhere at Soldier Field that the teams can get a fight in. This is going to look really sexy. This is going to harken back to the old days. There's a lot on the line for both these teams. Miami at 4-1 and 3-0, kind of emerging in the ACC, and the game with FSU is, you know, looks like it's going to be big, and they've got some playmakers, at least offensively, which kind of plays in with Notre Dame, which just kind of manages the game on offense, but is really good defensively. So I think this is going to be a great game, and whoever wins, it's going to be a statement game, because, you know, if Miami wins, they're going to be 5-1 and looking like a pretty good challenger in the ACC, and Notre Dame is going to be halfway through the season with one of their toughest schedules ever, and all of a sudden the remaining games don't look that tough because of those teams' quality and the way Notre Dame has played.
I'm looking at the Miami offensive line, which is talented but young and inexperienced, and this will be one of their toughest challenges. Other than Florida State, this will be their toughest challenge all season, because blocking guys like Tuitt and Nix and the rest of that Notre Dame front seven, it will be so important, because the one spot where I look at it and I see Miami having an advantage, it's with Rashawn Scott and Philip Dorsett, the two sophomores who lit up the NC State secondary last week. That's an NC State secondary that, with David Amerson and the rest of them, they considered one of the best in the ACC. And Notre Dame's secondary is young, and we haven't really seen them be tested by a big aerial attack. If the offensive line can give Stephen Morris just a little bit of time, Dorsett and Rashawn Scott are fast enough to be able to get behind those defenders, and we could see more of those 40-plus yard passes.
Yeah, and embarrassed Amerson last week a couple of times.
Yeah,
where he was, they showed shots of him on the bench, just shaking his head. You know, whether he didn't get safety help or something like that is another thing. But yeah, I agree. Notre Dame lost the starting corner in August, and it hasn't really mattered until now. And you know, and don't forget, Miami can run the ball with Duke Johnson too. I mean, they've got a really kind of varied attack here. It'll be very interesting to see what Notre Dame does. And you're right about Tuitt. He's a stuffer in the middle. And he's going to step on Tuitt, 300 pounds, but he's going to play in the NFL. There aren't many pros on Notre Dame's side of the ball. On defense, he might be the only one. But he's pretty plucky. That's why I love this matchup.
What's the send you out of here on this? What is one sort of under the radar interesting? You mentioned earlier like a sidebar story that you're looking forward to in week six.
Well, I think if I thought about this today, starting with Baylor, West Virginia will play six ranked teams in a 7-week span. And, you know, that, and I said all along, see, they have a team built perfectly for the Big 12, and that they can outscore anybody in the Big 12 and win it. But are we shooting too low here? You know, if they beat six ranked teams on their way to an undefeated season in a league that doesn't play a championship game, that's going to be, there's going to take some reckoning there at the end of the season on including them. So don't sleep on on Geno Smith in West Virginia, don't set your sights too low. I think the way it's looking, it could be much higher than worrying about the Heisman.
Really? So you think that if West Virginia, can they afford a loss along the way?
No.
No. Yeah.
Not for that. No, I mean, they can afford one and still win the Big 12. But no, I don't think they can afford a loss because there'll be others in competition. There'll be at least, we know, one ACC team will be up there. That's almost a given. And then Oregon, will make a push. But, listen to this. If they go, okay, they got Baylor at Texas, at Texas Tech. If they go through the number one defense in the country and win at Texas, then they get K-State at home, TCU at home, at Oklahoma State, who's unranked now, that may change, Oklahoma at home, and then they finish at Iowa State and Kansas, that's not out of the realm of possibility. The way those teams are shaking out, I mean, you're going to have to give them a lot of credit if they win at Texas and Texas Tech. Texas Tech beat number one Oklahoma last year, and they're a lot better than they were last year, a lot, especially defensively. So that'll be really fun to see how they match up. So I'm just saying, it's week six. A guy can dream, can't he?
You know what you're setting this up for, right? They're going to be undefeated through that tough stretch, and they're going to lose to Iowa State. And for the second year in a row, Iowa State's just going to throw everything up in the air in the last month of the season.
And Paul Rhodes will become another internet sensation, and he'll have more scalps on the wall in the last 3 years than just about anybody when you consider the upsets he's pulled.
He is Dennis Dodd. Don't forget, you can follow him on Twitter at Dennis Dodd CBS, and he will be in Gainesville for Florida and LSU, so be sure to check out the SEC Game of the Week, get all the updates with him, and remember to follow the Ion College Football blog at IonCFB. For Dennis Dodd, I'm Chip Patterson. Thanks so much for listening.